Do not attempt to change the channel.
All media are extensions of some human faculty.
Is books part of the media?
Media, we don't need it, do we?
Baby, this thing is bigger than all of us.
The media. A lot of you out there probably never even heard of the word.
Media is any form of communication. It can be radio, television, computers.
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
You know, we live in the most mediated society in world history. You spend 10 to 12 hours a day with media. And so I think it makes sense to think about, in a sort of systematic and sustained way, our relationship with media.
Welcome to Be the Media on CHLY 101.7 FM. I am your host today, Neil Scobie, filling in for Marian Van Der Zon. And here on Be the Media, we talk about all things media on this show, from the local to the global, including perspectives of consumers and producers of media. All contributors of Be the Media are faculty, students, and friends of the Media Studies Department and Media Research Lab at VIU. Once again, I am Neil Scobie. I am your host today. We got a full show for you, so sit tight, grab a cup of coffee or tea or whatever's keeping you warm today. Today's show, I'll let you know, we have Alina Williams, her segment Television Through This Mother's Lens, and today's topic, she tackles horror on television. We also have a short fictional piece by Kevin Mazatenik, and his series is called Paparazzi Trigger Finger. Later, I have an interview with Sonia Bianchi of Girls and Football SA, her program. She started in South Africa along with some other students, and they created a program for girls to play organized sport, and specifically football, soccer, as we call it, in South Africa. And we'll be playing that interview a little later in the show. And later, Robin Davies will follow up with further excerpts from The Oral Machine. Once again, you are tuned to 101.7 CHLY here in rainy Nanaimo. Yuck. But it's okay. It's Christmas season, holiday season, and it is upon us. So I hope you're all sitting tight and warm by your fireplace listening to Be the Media with me today. And thank you for joining us. So let's kick things off. Alina Williams, Television Through This Mother's Lens on CHLY.
Hello, my name is Alina Williams. I'm a faculty member in the Media Studies Department at Vancouver Island University, and I have a confession to make. I love television. I am also the mother of three girls, who range in age from 12 years old to less than a year, and I have discovered that having children in the house means that I need to be a lot more thoughtful about what I watch on TV. I know from both first-hand experience and from being a media professor that television images can have a major impact on a growing brain. So, when my husband and I decided to sit down and watch the season opener of The Walking Dead, I made sure my kids were safely tucked into bed. During the bone-chilling, heart attack-inducing one-hour show, I began to reflect on how the experience of watching flesh-eating dead people is quite different on television than it is in a movie. Stay with me today as I explain what made me think about television as a storytelling medium as I turn this mother's lens on television narrative. Let me state right up front that the horror genre is my least favorite genre to watch on either the large screen or the small screen, and the zombie subgenre is particularly difficult for me to stomach. Call me crazy, but I really don't like feeling like I've lost 5 years of my life because I am so freaking scared by what I see in front of me. Plus, it takes quite a long time for me to get images of dead people with flesh hanging off their bones and blood drying on their mouths out of my mind. But my husband really likes zombie shows, and he has been known to sit through many episodes of high school kids singing and dancing in glee with me, and in the interest of marital compromise, I am attempting to watch The Walking Dead with him. But I will admit that it is quite trying for me to do. The first episode was so intense that we ended up watching it over two nights because I had to stop watching after the first half hour into the show. During the second half hour and the second night, I had become a bit more accustomed to the tension and suspense of watching the hero wake up from a gunshot-induced coma to find the world occupied by thousands and thousands of shuffling monsters. He then spent the rest of the episode avoiding becoming a zombie meal while he attempted to reunite with his missing wife and son. Along the way, he meets a few living people and has many run-ins with dead ones. The Walking Dead is not my first experience with zombies. My husband eased me into the genre with Shaun of the Dead, which is a zombie comedy that incorporates many of the recognizable elements from the zombie genre, like the unfolding of the zombie apocalypse in which the society as we know it breaks down as the zombie pandemic spreads through bites by an infected person. Shaun of the Dead is an intentional play on the title of George Romero's 1978 film Dawn of the Dead, in which zombies are named for the first time. Romero is known as the father of the zombie genre, with his 1968 film, The Night of the Living Dead, and his depiction of zombies as shuffling creatures that act on retained memories of how to do basic physical functions, but do not possess intelligence. My husband chose wisely with my first zombie film, because the comedic elements of the movie Shaun of the Dead, as well as the choice to have slow, shambling zombies, would give my poor heart a chance to stop beating quite so hard once in a while. The recent mainstream hit Zombieland took a similar approach to the zombie genre by giving the audience a chance to relax during the narrative because of the humorous approach to surviving the zombie apocalypse. I find that watching zombies in a television format is quite a different experience from watching them in a traditional movie format. For me, it's not just because of the inclusion or exclusion of comedic aspects, but also because of the way that the narrative unfolds within the mediums themselves. Movies are pretty much a one-shot deal. You get in, meet the characters, watch them fight zombies, and then in the end there is resolution and a sense of closure that gives the audience a chance to relax and let the story and images fade from their brain because the experience is over. But with television, the story climaxes so that at the end of each episode, there is a pretty dramatic turn that hooks the viewer and ensures that they will return next week. What this means is that the viewer in their mind will keep returning to the events during the break until the next episode plays, and then the situation gets resolved. But of course, another situation that needs resolving begins and hooks the viewer again, and so on and so on. I like watching movies, and I enjoy the way that movies offer a real escape from my everyday life, at least for the 2 or 2.5 hours that I'm watching it. But I do prefer how television draws me into another world and really engages me in the story that I'm watching on the small screen. What television has that movies does not is a temporal advantage. Plots and stories can unfold over a very short period of time for one episode, or over a very long time, such as an entire season, or even during the entire timeline of a series. There are many narrative devices that television has at its disposal, whereas movies are relatively limited in how the characters can develop or how the plot can twist and turn within its fixed time span. Even when movies create franchises by having sequels or prequels, the result is rarely as gripping as some of the great television series like The Sopranos, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Star Trek The Next Generation, The Shield, and Deadwood. The past 5 or 10 years has produced so many great television series that I could use this whole segment just naming them, because what they share is great storytelling that draws the viewer in and keeps them tuned in week after week or episode after episode to watch the characters grow and develop and change with time. I think of HBO's The Shield and Deadwood as amazing examples of characters who develop beyond the black and white of good or bad into the more realistic portrayals of people who have both good and bad in them, and who we both admire and revile at the same time. Joss Whedon, the writer and director of the Buffy series, is admired for the way he used the medium of television to his storytelling advantage by having his school-aged main characters go off on summer breaks that took place concurrently with the summer break between each season. Whedon is also known for his strong character development that occurs over the entire span of a series. His follow-up show to Buffy was Firefly, which had all the necessary elements to become successful in the same way that Buffy was. But it failed to capture audience numbers. Some believe it is because the network broadcast the episodes of Firefly's first and only season out of sequence from what Whedon had written. Once the series was released on DVD and the viewers could experience the story in the way that Whedon meant for it to be watched, Firefly gained the fan following that had originally been expected for it. In fact, Firefly developed a significant enough popularity on DVD that a follow-up movie was produced 3 years after the original series aired so that fans could have some closure with the characters that they had grown attached to. For me, it is the effect of television narrative on character development that makes TV a better storytelling medium than movies, and it is what makes the zombie genre even more terrifying. When I was watching that first episode of The Walking Dead, I noticed that at least two of the zombies seemed to have slightly more cognitive abilities than the rest of the horde around them. They seemed to be somewhat more human. And a question was raised for me about whether or not these zombies might be able to evolve into more intentional killing creatures as the series goes on. The thought of this freaks me out completely, but it also makes me inclined to want to tune in again to find out whether I'm right, despite the negative effects on my nervous system. And that is how this mother views the power of narratives within the medium of television.
That this is thriller, a thrill night. would ever dare try. Thriller night. So let me hold you tight and share a killer. Hold you tight and share a killer's thrill tonight.
You're tuned to 101.7 FM CHLY, and that is Imogen Heap with Thriller. And I've been told that that's actually a cover song by a very famous musician. Once again, this is Be The Media. I'm your host today, Neil Scobie, and thanks for joining us today. Next up is a short fictional piece by Kevin Mazutenik, Paparazzi Trigger Finger. But before we get into it, I'd like to remind you about our podcasts. If you enjoy listening to Be The Media, I welcome you to go to chly.ca, go to the podcast page on the right, and you'll see under the B is Be The Media. This is our 11th show, so you can go back in time and check out our previous episodes, and I welcome and encourage you to do so. And if you have any comments or thoughts, complaints, anything of that sort, email us bethemedia@viu.ca. This is Kevin Mazutenik. Paparazzi Trigger Finger is the name of the piece on Be The Media, CHLY 101.7 FM.
Sometimes you smash two things together and nothing. Other times, kaboom.
Paparazzi Trigger Finger.
I'm Kevin Mazutenik, and welcome to Paparazzi Trigger Finger. At the sound of the turning page, we will begin a new fiction. Gaze of the Ankle Witch. Page 67. Usually I wouldn't bother. This time, I did. Chapter 27. Back on the couch again. Okay, the very last thing I remember, after the B-52 bomber careening off my forehead, is a flash of reflected light. I'm not entirely certain as to whether it was from Jennifer's braces, or the chrome from the leg of the snack table. After that, nothing. Have you any idea who threw it? At the time or now? At the time. Nope. All I remember is that... Funny, actually. What's funny, Edwin? Well, it was during a Remembrance Day celebration. Okay, then. What is the next thing you remember? Urine. I remember the sound of urine. Someone relieving themselves? No, not really. I don't think it was done for relief. More out of fear. Stage fright. And the sound wasn't really the urine. It was the sound of dripping liquid. Urine? Sure, Doc. Write that down if you need to. Carry on. There was urine dripping from the bleachers down onto the upright bass drum in the band area below. Had it not been for the fact that I had landed with my head right beside it, I may never have even noticed. Then, when I looked to my right, there on the floor beside me was my poppy. It had fallen out of my sweater vest during my collapse. There was a growing pool of urine spreading out towards it. I grabbed it quickly and sat up. Hey... did you ever notice how those plastic poppies look like bullet entry wounds? I can't say as I've ever made that connection, no. Page 6. Could come in that color. It is beautiful, though. Good. That's sort of the whole point. What does it mean? Well, that's where it gets a little foggy. I mean, that's right where I'm trying to figure it out. The words don't seem to work for me. It's like I can't push them together properly. I can't figure out exactly what to tell you. Wait! She practically scares him off the front step. In all fairness, it is frost-covered this early in the evening. It's the humidity. The temperature of the evening is just wacko, cold enough for frost, yet warm enough to, once acclimatized, wander around in the evening air with little more than a sweater. That's not what I meant. He just looks at her. Then, as if rolling a salty cashew into the tips of the forefinger and thumb on the left hand in pre-pop prep, he gives his skull a shake, just to rattle the eyes around, to wake him back up a little. Sometimes, like right now, they need it. We all need it. Then exactly what did you mean? She tightens her lips as laughter in its politeness remains inaudible and confined to the rattling of her chest. A smile then cracks up her cheeks and winks both eyes just a touch before igniting them like a blue dragon candle. Oh, God. You meant what does the color mean, didn't you? And she just keeps laughing. Ah, right. Right. It means mystery or attaining the impossible. Cool. And then I found out that it, to some, means fantasy and impossibility. Her laughing ebbs. The smile is still there, though. Some also believe it symbolizes hope. Hope for a miracle and new possibilities. If truth could ascend to the surface, roll over, and offer up its pink underbelly for a good scratching, it would tell you now, over blissful squeaks and sighs, that only until minutes before this moment had arrived, he knew none of this. He certainly didn't make the choice based on these connotations. All of this was revealed after the fact. Sometimes you smash two things together and nothing. Other times, kaboom.
Thank you for tuning in. And once again, this is Kevin Mazatenik from Paparazzi Trigger Finger.
Sonia Bianchi is a Nanaimo resident and University of Victoria graduate in political science and history. She has worked, volunteered, and served on the board of directors for several charities locally and in South Africa, where she is currently pursuing a master's degree. While studying in South Africa, Sonia, along with some fellow students, founded Girls and Football SA to ensure underprivileged girls in South Africa have equal access to play sports. They also filmed a documentary entitled Can I Kick It? The Untold Story of Women's Football in South Africa. I recently had the pleasure to speak with Sonia about this amazing project. Sonia, thanks for joining us on Be the Media.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tell us about this impressive project, Girls and Football SA, and how it all got started.
Sure. So I'm from Nanaimo, lived here all my life and went to university in Victoria, and I started doing a master's program in South Africa. So I'm in Stellenbosch, South Africa, and a co-classmate of mine decided to do a documentary about women's football and the importance of female sports and how development can be done through sporting activities and used as a tool. So she had this idea of telling the story of the women's national team. And part of the documentary was going to be doing a workshop with girls from townships and rural communities and the national team. And I thought to myself, well, as we started doing interviews, I started helping her with the project, it really became evident that the thing that South Africa needs is an opportunity for girls at a young age to play sports. There's no opportunities for them to play in an organized league. There's no real opportunities through schools for girls to be active in that way. So as we did the interviews, it became really clear that this is a hole that needed to be filled. So we started the program, not just doing the documentary, but also doing actual workshops. So we do three things. We did the documentary. We do media attention for women's sports. So we do that through blogs. We do that on a blog called Supersport, which is actually South Africa's version of TSN. We write about women's sports and professionally. We also write articles for publications online as well as in print, different avenues that we can get information out that way. And then we also do the actual workshops. So we go into townships. We recruit girls from schools. ages 10 to 12, we have four teams currently active right now in the communities, and there's about 20 girls per team.
So is there a stigma attached to playing sports as associated with girls?
Absolutely. There's a stigma attached to playing sports anywhere, any women athletes. There's huge stigmas attached to the way they're perceived, whether, you know, it's feminine to be an athlete, whether it's, you know, there's a lot of, especially in South Africa, it's a very patriarchal society still, and I think a lot of girls face, and a lot of women athletes face, those sorts of things on a day-to-day basis. And just to add even more to that, it's also you're also sort of considered to be butch as a female athlete. And that in South Africa is very prominent. And actually just, I think, a year or two ago, one of the national team players, who was an open lesbian, was killed in a township because she was so open about her sexuality. And it's really not looked upon... It's not looked upon very, very well there. And, I mean, townships are a dangerous place to begin with, but she was specifically targeted because of her... She was an athlete. She didn't conform to what the normal stereotype of what a female should be in South Africa, and because she was openly gay. And there's a lot of stigma attached to those things in South Africa, and the athletes face a lot of challenges because of it.
So what was the age group of girls that you were recruiting, and did you find a reluctance from the girls to play football?
Yeah, so South Africa just hosted the FIFA World Cup this year, so soccer is crazy there. Everywhere you go, there's a vuvuzela, there's a soccer ball, everywhere. So getting the girls was a breeze. Everyone wanted to play. We got to, you hold a ball in a township, in a community, anywhere you go in South Africa, and you have 50 kids next to you wanting to play. So that wasn't a problem at all. And actually gaining support from the community was something we had anticipated having a lot of issues around. But it wasn't at all. We got there, and the girls were itching to play. The teachers were itching to facilitate, and the parents were really on board because they realize what kind of opportunities sports can play for these young girls. So it was not a problem. The girls that we recruited were working with ages 10 to 12. So that's grade 4, 5, and 6, kind of. And we're choosing them because there's no formal opportunity for them to play. We're hoping to build the league as we grow so we can incorporate them later on as well when they get older and have leagues for older girls and to start at a young age so it's still really influential in their lives.
What kind of obstacles did you face in forming your project?
I think we face a lot of the same obstacles any NGO is going to face when they're starting out. Funding is the first and foremost. I mean, we're using borrowed balls right now from the university. I transport all the volunteers myself. So, I mean, there's all those costs that are associated with it. And as a student, you know, those can be quite tricky to handle. So funding is the main obstacle. Secondly, there's just a lot of bureaucracy in South Africa. So kind of getting anything officially done can be quite a challenge, whether it's a funding application or whether it's support from another NGO or a government body. It can be very difficult to do. Also, being women, you sort of face a bit of a different... It's a bit different because I'm North American, so I kind of get a little bit more respect right away. But I'm still a woman, so there's still a lot of kind of, oh, isn't that cute? You're starting a soccer league. Like, oh, that's so nice, you know. Oh, it's very patronizing sometimes. So that's a bit of an issue once in a while. But more than anything, we've found a lot of support for it. So
was there any resistance at all? Like within the communities?
No, there wasn't any resistance at all. I mean, we started with going to the schools first. So we talked to the principals of the schools we were operating in. We always get a female staff member to support the team. So that's always someone that will be there every week with us as well. And every school we've been to, there's been an overwhelming amount of support for the team. So it was really surprising, but I mean, it makes sense. They're soccer crazy right now in South Africa. So, yeah, and people were starting to hear about the women's national team, but they weren't quite as popular, obviously, as the men's team. So once we started to discuss the fact that, you know, there might be some opportunities later on to, you know, introduce the girls, or that we've been working with the South African national team, you know, doors started to open and it became really quickly developed.
And the women's team, correct me if I'm wrong, is actually ranked higher in their individual world ranking than the men's?
It changes all the time, depending on every game that they do. And they just did an African's Women's Cup, which is a qualifying tournament for African teams for the Women's World Cup that's happening next year in Germany. So they just had that in South Africa. They hosted it in Johannesburg. And unfortunately, the national team came third, which just makes it, they just didn't qualify for the World Cup, which is quite unfortunate. But they're ranked three in Africa. So that's pretty, that's higher than the men's team as yeah. well. And I believe they're ranked higher globally. I mean, like I said, it changes all the time, but they're a really stellar team. And their program that they've set out, they have under 17 team as well. They have all of these different levels that they work within. And the under 17 team made South African records. They were the first team to qualify for any World Cup tournament uh-huh. on their own. So they competed this past year in August, I believe. They competed in Trinidad and Tobago. Uh-huh. So the under 17 team is women's team is looking very promising as well.
Yeah. Since starting Girls in Football SA, have there been similar projects risen because of the success of yours?
Well, we've just been operating since March 2010, so we're mm-hmm. still very new. There are a lot of sport development projects that are operating in all countries across the world, in Canada as well as in many African countries everywhere. But the difference between us and them is that they either focus on specifically boys, because sport is seen as a very good tool to develop boys and men yeah. in post-conflict areas, that sort of thing, developing countries, or they're using mixed teams, so girls and boys. But we're the only all-female sport development project operating in South Africa. So we focus on girls, we only take girls onto our teams, and we only have females coaching. So we have some, some male people that are helping us behind the scenes, supporters and mentors, people that are working with the organization of the whole ordeal. But the people that deal with the girls every day, they're all female. So it creates a safe space for the girls to be themselves, for them to open up, for them to talk to us about issues they may not want to speak about in front of boys. And it creates kind of a little bit of a sisterhood as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, you recently had a fun drive here in Nanaimo. Can you talk about that and tell us how that went?
Yeah, I was home for 3 weeks, and I'm heading back to South Africa now again. And during these 3 weeks, we did a donation drive with the Nanaimo Parks and Recreation, which is very great. They came on board and offered us venues to host boxes to collect gently used items for me to bring back for the girls. So the girls currently play in their school uniforms, which are dresses and dress shoes. So it's very difficult for them to actually progress because they're starting to trip and twist their ankles or skid. So it's kind of hard for them to keep, to play their hardest. So what we've been doing is we've been collecting shoes and shorts and soccer balls and shin pads so that I can bring them back with me.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Now, so Nanaimo really stepped up, and they were, everyone was so amazing in donating. Nanaimo Youth Soccer League also donated 2 batches of their old jerseys that we can use for games. There's numerous balls were donated. I don't
Terrific.
Even know how much. I can't even count it all. We've gotten so many overwhelmingly great donations.
Can now, since the fund drive is over, can people still donate in some way or form?
Yeah, absolutely. We have we're always open for online donations. Our website is www.girlsandfootballsa.com, and on there's a donation button, and anything that you donate, we can allocate to actually providing equipment with the girls for the girls. Also, we can be emailed at info@girlsandfootballsa.com, and you can send any information there. And if you'd like to be involved in some way, you can drop us a line and I'll get in touch with you and we can organize something. We'd love to connect more girls teams here to teams in South Africa. So we have 2 teams in Nanaimo and one team in Nanaimo, 1 team in Victoria, that has stepped up and sponsored a team. And so we're working with them to create a link and pass the girls' information along and poke pictures and kind of create bonds across great distances.
Now, the documentary, it's called Can I Kick It?
Yes.
Now, and you had a showing recently in Victoria, is that correct?
We used it as a fundraiser, so it wasn't an official showing. We showed clips of it and gave everybody a little bit of a taste. Yeah. So we used it as a fundraiser in Victoria with in partnership with an organization called Positively Africa, which is another great African-based NGO. And we showed it, and it was great. I mean, it's 28 minutes long. We haven't, like I said, officially released it yet, but it's going to be hopefully entered into some festivals. It's all based, it's the untold story of women's football in South Africa. So it's the whole focus of the documentary is to tell the stories of the women that are, and the challenges they face in playing every day, in playing at a high level, and how they got there. what the sport has given them and how it can help South Africa develop in the future, especially the women.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. What are the long-term goals of Girls in Football SA?
Absolutely. So we hope to, like I said, enter the documentary into festivals, have it shown a lot of different places. We want to continue to advocate for women's sports and bring media attention to it because that's what's needed in order to break down those stigmas, in order to make it, you know, okay for girls to be athletes as well, and as